And now please open your Bibles to Psalm 19, verse 1, for the text of our lesson this morning. Psalm 19, verse 1. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. Well, some of you remember that in 1986, Halley's Comet made a circle close to the earth, and that became something that was in the news again. It had been a long, long time since that had been in the news. It was 75 years before that, the last time that Halley's Comet had made the news. And I'll have to admit that was before my time. But that will make the news again in 75 years after 1986. I haven't stopped to try to calculate exactly when that will be, but I don't expect to be here when it comes back around another time. That comet was first identified, I believe it was, I have it on here, in 1758, yes, by 1682, by Edwin Halley, and so it became Halley's Comet. And it comes around in a very regular way every 75 years, and they can calculate exactly when it's going to be here, and then it goes back out into the deep recesses of space, far out of view of anything that we're able to capture with, because it goes so far out into deep space. But because of this comet and others like it that make a regular orbit around the sun, astronomers have been able to figure out a very complex formula. I don't understand it, but it's a very complex formula to tell us concerning the orbits of comets around the sun. It'd be interesting if you're into astronomy to try to understand that very, very complex formula. But there's something about that. There's something about the fact that these comets come at certain times and in just the exact amount of time that the astronomers have been able to calculate when they'll be here. We can observe them. They go back out into deep space. And this happens on a regular basis. There's something about that that tells us something about the universe, about this great expanse in which we live, that we must understand in order to come to a full appreciation of the wisdom and the power of God. We want to talk about what that means today. We're going to talk about why we believe that there is a God. Now, I'm going to use some scripture to show why I use the approach that I'm using. But the evidence that we're going to use is not from the scriptures, but although we could rightfully use evidence from the scriptures to show that there is a God, such as fulfilled prophecy. But I'm going to use evidence from science itself to show why we ought to believe that there's one true and living God and that He has the nature of the God who is described in the Bible. Now, I cannot prove by the scientific method that God exists. The scientific method is called the empirical method. That means observation and experimentation. For something to be truly a matter of science, then you have to see it happening, and it has to be repeatable in experiments anywhere in the world at any time if those same conditions are put together. And if you can't do that, then really it's not a matter of science. That, by the way, is the reason this whole thing about where did the earth and where did the universe come from and where did life come from on the earth, that's really not a matter of science. You can use scientific evidence to bolster what you believe about it, and I believe the scientific evidence is on the side of creation. But it's not a matter of science because you can't see the world begin. You cannot in any way duplicate that in an experiment somewhere. You can't see life on the earth begin. You can't see that, have that duplicated somewhere. By the way, if you think life has been produced in the test tube, it's not been ever produced in the test tube. And cell biologists now understanding the complex nature of one cell don't think that it ever will be produced in the test tube. So that's not something that truly is a matter of science. It's a matter of philosophy or a matter of faith. It's not a matter of science. We'll say more about that as we get into it. But I do believe that we cannot demonstrate scientifically the existence of God for a simple reason. God does not physically exist. He spiritually exists. He is a spirit. In John chapter 4, verse 24, Jesus said God is a spirit. Those who worship Him must worship in spirit and truth. God does not have a fleshly body as you and I have. He is a spirit. That's what Jesus said in Luke chapter 24, verse 39. When He had appeared to His disciples after His resurrection from the dead, and they thought that He was a spirit, and He said, "Look, behold my hands and my feet, that is I, myself. Handle me and see, for a spirit does not have flesh and bones, as you see that I have." So a spirit just exists in a realm other than the material realm. God is a spirit. He does not exist in the material realm. He does not have a body of flesh and bones. We cannot demonstrate by the scientific method, by empirical observation, that God is by seeing God or repeating the observation of God Himself. And in fact, He is invisible. This is what Paul says about it in Colossians 1:13. Now there, he's describing the nature of Jesus, but he says He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. So God is a spirit. God is invisible. I cannot see Him. Nobody can see Him at any time. Nobody has seen God in His form as God at any time because He is invisible. So it's not a matter of scientific method. It's not a matter of the empirical method. I cannot prove by the scientific method the existence of God, but at the same time, an atheist cannot prove by the scientific method that it does not exist. It's not a question of science, so far as the fact that God exists or does not exist. In order, I want you to think about this, in order for an atheist to prove by the empirical method, by observation and experimentation, that God does not exist, that atheist would have to be in all parts of the universe at the same time and exist both in the spiritual and the physical realm. And then since God is not really a part of His universe but above the universe, He'd have to get outside the universe. Now, I don't think any atheist is going to do that. In fact, if he were able to do that, that would make him God himself. To prove there's not a God, he would have to become God. So it's just simply not a matter of the empirical method. It's not a scientific question. And God wants us to serve Him by faith. In Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6, the inspired writer says, "But without faith it is impossible to please Him, for he who comes to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him." God wants those who serve Him to serve Him by faith. Well, what is faith? Look at Hebrews chapter 11, verses 1 through 3. The fact that we serve Him by faith does not mean that we have no reason for what we believe. It doesn't mean that we make just a blind leap in the dark. Oh, no, not at all. But faith is conviction that is based on testimony. It is a reasonable conviction. There's a reason for our convictions. In Hebrews chapter 11, verses 1 through 3, the inspired writer says, "Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen." The New American Standard renders this, "Faith is the conviction of things hoped for." And he says, the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Now look at both of those. It's the substance. That's literally correct. It's that which stands under and upholds, or it gives us assurance of things that we hope for but we do not see. But it is evidence or conviction. That is, it's conviction that is based on evidence of things not seen. Faith begins in the realm of the unseen. I've never seen God. You've never seen God. But it comes to rest also in the realm of the unseen. I hope for a home in heaven, and I'm sure that you do too, but you've never seen heaven, and I've never seen heaven. So faith begins and ends in the realm of the unseen, not because there's no evidence, but it's a different kind of evidence. It's not empirical. It's not a matter of observing these things and being able to repeat these by observation, by experimentation. That's not the nature of our faith. That's not the nature of the question. He goes ahead to say, "For by it the elders obtained a good testimony. By faith we understand," notice carefully, verse 3, "we understand that the worlds were framed by the Word of God, so that things which are seen were not made of things which are visible." There is the invisible nature of the things in which we believe. Let me ask you a question. You don't have to raise your hand. How many believe that in 1492 Columbus discovered America? Now, anybody that's been through American schools believes that, don't you? That he actually discovered one of the islands of the West Indies. But in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Everybody knows that, right? Let me ask you, how many saw that happen? Now, I don't think anybody here saw that happen, okay? And I don't think it can be repeated by observation and experimentation. It's not a scientific question. It's an historical question. There's a difference between things that happen historically and things that happen scientifically that can be produced over and over again by observation and experimentation. Actually, this is a question of philosophy. We can gather evidence from various realms. We can gather evidence from history. We can gather evidence from science. But ultimately, it's a matter of faith. Do we believe in God or do we not believe in God on the basis of the evidence for things that we cannot see? So I don't claim to be able to prove that there is a God by observation and experimentation. But I do claim that the atheist cannot disprove his existence by observation and experimentation. I do believe that there's more evidence from various realms of the existence of God than that there is that He does not exist. So here's the question then. Is there sufficient evidence to cause a reasonable, honest person to believe that God exists? Or is there not enough evidence? Now what I want to do in the remainder of our time is to look at some basic principles from the realm of natural science that anybody who claims to be a scientist would have to concede. Indeed, those are as basic of principles as there are in the realm of natural science. And if we'll stop and think about those, we'll see that reasoning upon these basic principles of natural science will cause us to conclude that there is one true and living God. The first thing I want to look at is the law of causality. There must be an adequate cause for the greatest of all natural effects, that is, the universe itself. When we think about things, there's the law of cause and effect is called. There must be an adequate cause for every effect. And we know, of course, that for science to deal with it, that has to deal with a natural cause. Let me give an example of what I'm talking about. We remember that a couple of years ago there was a great tsunami in southeastern Asia that killed thousands of people. And some people had the question, well, was that an act of God? Was that God's judgment on those people? Well, apart from a direct revelation from God, I don't know. I can't answer that question because there's nothing in the Bible that tells me yes or no. I don't have. And science cannot deal with that. That's not a scientific question. A scientist would simply say, well, there was the movement of some tectonic plates down under the ocean that caused shock waves to go out, and those shock waves manifest themselves on the shore in the form of a great tsunami that had a great wall of water that came ashore and killed a lot of people. And he would explain everything from a natural standpoint. Now, we might want to know, well, what's the reason that happened from the standpoint point of morality? What's the moral reason that it happened? And I have to say, I don't know, because the Bible doesn't reveal, and science cannot deal with the question. But that's the law of cause and effect. It's the basis of science. For every effect, there has to be an adequate cause from a natural or scientific standpoint. If there's not, then there's no such thing as science. That's what science deals with from a standpoint of natural science. The law of causality, the law of cause and effect. Well, here we have the universe around us as the greatest of all effects, the greatest of all natural effects. What caused it to come into being? There has to be something there that caused it to come into being. Now, by the way, the New Age is a popular thing in religion today. And it's based in Hinduism. Hinduism believes in pantheism. That is, that there's not a God who is above as the creator of the universe, but God and the universe are one and the same thing. Well, that doesn't answer anything. Where did the universe come from? If God and the universe are the same thing, if everything is God and God is everything, that's pantheism, that's Hinduism, then what caused it all? Where did it all come from? It doesn't answer anything. What's very popular today among atheistic scientists, there are believing scientists, but among atheistic scientists, is that, well, there was a Big Bang. Behind the Big Bang, what was there? It had to come from somewhere. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? Well, they don't have an answer. I have an answer. I believe the chicken came first. But I don't believe they have an answer. Which they don't have any way of telling us what caused the universe to come into being. Now, I'll say more about that when we get to the second thing, and that is the law of thermodynamics, the first law of thermodynamics. So this is the most basic principle of physical science. That is that energy can neither be created nor destroyed, but can only change in from one form to another. Now, when I was in school a long time ago, when I was a teenager 50 years ago, what they taught was the atom is composed of electrons, protons, and neutrons. And I think that's as far as we got into the existence of matter. That may have been all that was known scientifically at that time. But since then, of course, they've built these great atom smashers like they have up close to Chicago and one over in Switzerland, where they get these subatomic particles going at almost the speed of light around this thing, and they crash them into each other, and from that they have very tiny subatomic particles that come out, and the reason they do that is to try to discover the nature of energy and the nature of matter. And now they talk about subatomic particles that make up the electrons, protons, neutrons, like quarks, and have all kinds of funny names like that, and I'm not very up on that kind of stuff, but nonetheless they get down to incredibly tiny. What they've discovered is this: that in essence, there's no difference between matter and energy. That matter is simply when energy comes together to make up atoms, and then it comes together to make up molecules and so forth, they're just interchangeable. That you don't change, you don't get rid of energy at all. It changes from one form to another. All right, so here's the point. Energy can either be created or destroyed. It can only be changed in form. Where did it come from to begin with? Now, the Big Bang doesn't answer anything. That's a lot of energy. Okay? But where did that energy come from? Well, you can have a universe that's expanding and coming back, expanding, but that still doesn't answer anything. That's just keeping on chicken, egg, chicken, egg, chicken, egg. Somewhere, either a chicken or an egg had to come from. It had to start somewhere. And there's no scientific answer for that. Science, apart from God, has no answer. It gives me no problem at all. In the beginning, God created. It's not a problem. But the atheist who rejects the Bible has no answer for where it all came from originally. It could not have existed forever. Now that's what's, oh, it's just been around forever. There was no beginning. Cannot be. Because of the second law of thermodynamics. This is another of the most basic laws of physical science, the most basic laws of physics. The second law of thermodynamics is also called the law of entropy. That means that in a closed system, there is a tendency to disorder, to randomness. There is a loss of usable energy. That's not complicated. We all understand it. We use it every day. When you get in the car to go somewhere, you don't check to see if you have more gas than you had before. You check to see, have I run out of gas? Do I need to go buy some more gas? If it were not for entropy, just keep on driving forever and not have to worry about any gas in that tank. It doesn't work that way. You have to renew. There's a closed system. Now, the car is not completely a closed system because there is the escape of energy. Heat escapes. But more or less, it's a closed system. And in order to keep that thing going, you have to put more energy into that closed. Things run down. The universe had to begin at some time. It could not have existed forever. Because if it had existed forever, it would now be absolute zero. What's that? 450 degrees below zero, something like that. It would not, in other words, everything would be cold, lifeless, and dead. In fact, so cold we couldn't imagine how cold it is. If you think it's cold at the North Pole, you ain't seen nothing yet compared to absolute zero. So that will be the result if the universe had existed forever. There had to be a beginning. How did it begin? Scientists, apart from God, have no answer. Something else we need to understand about our universe. There is amazing order in incomprehensible complexity. The more that you see the Hubble Space Telescope, and I love to see the photographs taken by the Hubble Space Telescope, and they are just mind-boggling to realize what's out there. And the, as somebody, I think it's Roger that sent to me the picture, that they took a picture with the Hubble Space Telescope of a place that they thought was empty in space. And now they see there's trillions of galaxies. And you know, galaxies are millions of stars out there in what they thought was before just empty space. And they keep going farther and farther. The complexity of it is just, it's beyond my ability to imagine. The distances involved, they're measured in millions of light years. Do you know what a light year is? That's the distance that light travels in a year. Light travels at the speed of 186,000 miles in 1 second. Light years, millions of light years. I think I have a computer that can calculate that kind of stuff. And I know my mind can. It's beyond my comprehension. But now think about this. Back in, I think it was 1975, that NASA started to send out the Explorer satellites to explore not the universe, but to explore the solar system, the sun and the planets that revolve around the sun. You say nine, I think they say eight now. But nonetheless, to explore the solar system. And that involves, of course, millions and millions and millions of miles. But in order to do that, they had to do some calculations that would be roughly equivalent, and I've heard this from somebody that's in the know, be roughly equivalent if you were using a .22, a rifle, and trying to shoot the eye of a fly at a mile away. That would be roughly the equivalent of the kind of calculation. I'm not that good a shot, but of the kind of calculations that they had to do to send those satellites out and to make them orbit around one and then be slung out by that one, and then go and to orbit another planet and keep going until finally to exit our solar system. But all of the laws of that scientists have discovered in by observation experimentation had to be working everywhere in parts of the universe. Gravity had to be working, centrifugal force had to be working, everything had to be working exactly the way they calculated it on the Earth, or it would not have worked. And yet there is that Mars rover roving around on Mars taking photographs and sending them back to Earth because it all works the same. Now, let me try to illustrate this for you. In 1976, my family and I, and the kids were little bitty, made a trip from down the Texas Gulf Coast where we lived then. And we wound up in Vancouver, British Columbia. But along the way, and I was preaching. And we went through South Dakota. And as we were going through western South Dakota, we first came to the Badlands. And everything's tumbled up and jumbled up. And you can say, well, people say that's just nature at work. And nobody would think there's any design behind that. Just like everything's a matter of tumble and jumble. But then we came to the Black Hills of South Dakota. And you drive far enough back into those Black Hills, you come to a place called Mount Rushmore. And there on Mount Rushmore, you see a picture carved out in the rock, in the granite, of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt. And when we got there, of course, there was a storm, we didn't get to see it. But I think my wife and daughter saw it this year. But nonetheless, just say we got there and we saw it. And I were to say, well, isn't it marvelous how just wind and dust and all just carved our four presidents in the side of that hill? Now, if you believe that, I've got a Brooklyn Bridge I want to sell to you. Right? That is evidence of design. That's evidence that there's intelligence behind it. Where you have great complexity, and in that great complexity you have perfect order, then there is proof that there is great intellect, there's great intelligence. It's not a matter of chance. All the atheist can say is this is a cosmic accident. It's just a matter of rolling the dice. It just happened to be. If you're able to believe that, you've got more faith than I have. That's faith in that which is indeed nonsensical. So we have amazing order in incomprehensible complexity. Well, we want to look at something else. We want to look at life on earth. First of all, life itself could not be by chance. That's the law of biogenesis. That's the most basic law of life sciences, of biology. That life on this earth is simply, it cannot be generated artificially. It's that which is, life only comes about from prior life in a continuous function upon this earth. No life from non-life. Now back in the Middle Ages, back in what's called the Dark Ages, people believe that there's a bunch of slop out there, then rats and mice and flies would just generate themselves from that slop or from that mud or from all that filth that was simply thrown out. And they thought it just generated itself naturally. But there's a man by the name of Louis Pasteur in the 18th century did the swan neck flask experiments. And from those, he demonstrated, and it's never been in any way contradicted, the law of biogenesis. Life only comes from prior life in an unbroken chain on this earth. And by the way, that's a direct quote from a leading biologist, University of Central Arkansas, who was an evolutionist and whom I debated in 1978 on creation evolution. He said in his textbook that he wrote for use in college, life only come from prior life in an unbroken chain on this earth. All right. Life's here. Where did it come from? Now, do you know why that there's such a big thing today about aliens and people coming in and starting colonies here from outer space? Do you know why that's so popular today? It's popular because evolutionists know they have no explanation for where life came from. So instead of believing in the obvious conclusion, in the beginning God created, they have to come up with fantastic, ridiculous theories. Why, there were some shapes out in the cornfield. How'd they get there? Give me a break! I don't have enough faith to fall for such nonsense as that. Life came from somewhere. And by the way, it wasn't from some alien spaceship. In the beginning, God created is such an obvious answer that, well, I'm going to conclude this by the kind of person that would not. But there's something else about life. Life has within it various kinds of irreducible complexity. That is, things about living things that are so complex you cannot reduce them to simple things and explain how they got here. The feathers on the wings of a bird, if those feathers were just starting from something there like a scale, that's the evolutionist answer, then along the way they got in the way. And they caused those things to not be able to successfully reproduce and they'd be wiped out. So they wouldn't continue to reproduce. And you can't, there's some things you can't, the human eye, well, in fact, let's get to a better eye, the eye of an eagle or the eye of a hawk. You cannot reduce that to something like a spot on that was sensitive to light that caused that organism to be successful. So it was successful in reproduction and had an advantage over others. Instead, it would be something that if it just happened wrong, be in the way. Something it's irreducible complexity on the part of living organisms that cannot be explained by simply rolling the dice. It cannot be explained by chance. It cannot be explained by organic evolution. It can only be explained by, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. So, we must come to the conclusion there has to be something outside of the universe. Something outside the realm of nature, which is the cause of this great thing we call the universe and all that's in it, including life upon this earth. By a supernatural, uncaused first cause. And by the word supernatural, all I mean is it's outside the realm of that which is natural, outside the realm of nature. Now, if we stop and think about that, What kind of a supernatural, uncaused first cause would it be? What would it take to adequately explain the universe as scientists now are beginning to understand a little bit about it? Well, it'd have to be infinitely powerful. It's so much power we cannot imagine the power that's involved, so much energy. We cannot imagine all the energy that's involved. The sun, which is one small star in one small solar system, in one small part of the Milky Way, which is one galaxy and myriads of galaxies in the universe, the sun burns up 4,500,000 tons of its own mass in 1 second, generating radiant energy. And yet the sun, you know, if the Lord doesn't return, will continue to exist as it is for millions of more years unless the Lord returns. That's just one tiny, tiny, tiny part of the universe that's here. Whatever is behind the universe is infinite, unlimited in its power. But whatever is behind the universe is unlimited in intelligence, because you have this incredibly large, incredibly complex universe that operates with precision. The laws in all parts of the universe that scientists are able to find operate the same everywhere that we explore, whether it's by a satellite or whether it's by looking through the Hubble Space Telescope or something like that. It's always the same. Perfect order in incomprehensible complexity. Now, that's intelligence beyond anything that we can even comprehend, much less equal in anything that we do. So you've got infinite power, you've got infinite intelligence, and it has to be something that existed eternally. Eternal existence, because it had to be before the universe began. Now, let me ask you something. If I talk about something that has infinite power, that is sometimes we say omnipotent, that has infinite intelligence, sometimes we say that's omniscience, infinite intelligence, and something that existed eternally, what did I just describe? I just described the God of the Bible, didn't I? And that's what we see. What we have there are the divine attributes. And that's the reason the Apostle Paul said in Romans chapter 1, when he's talking about why the Gentiles need God, because they've rejected the knowledge of God. Romans 1, 18 through 21, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because what may be known of God is manifest to them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His power, His intelligence, His eternal existence, His invisible attributes are clearly seen." Now that's a contradiction if you take that literally. How can we clearly see what is invisible? He's not talking about this eye. He's talking about this eye. "Being understood by the things that are made. When I see the world, I must ask, how did it get here? How does it continue to operate with the precision with which it operates? How can scientists always discover things working the same way everywhere they look? His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead." That word Godhead means His divine nature, His divine attributes. "So that they are without excuse." Anybody who denies the existence of God is without excuse, because although they knew God, they did not glorify Him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts. Listen to me. Stephen Hawking is one of the most smartest men. He's the Einstein, I guess, of the present generation. He denies the existence of God. I don't care how smart he is. His thoughts are futile and his foolish heart is darkened. Became futile. Useless is what that word futile means. Useless in their thoughts. And their foolish heart was darkened. indeed. The evidence is conclusive. And that's the reason that David could say in Psalm 14, verse 1, "The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God." Quick story, and the lesson's yours. It's around 1970, 71. Now, part of what I'm going to tell you actually happened. Part of it's just a story, okay? I made a foolish decision. My wife was opposed to that foolish decision, but she, being a good wife, let me go ahead and make my foolish decision. I decided that we needed to buy the Encyclopedia Britannica. We didn't have the money, but we had children. We've got to educate those children. So I, on time, it was very expensive. All 30 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica, all fancy binding, and get a yearbook every year, for as long as you keep paying them. Oh, I thought that was it. I was so proud of that 30 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, that's a true story. All right, now, this is just a story. Where did that Encyclopedia Britannica come from? 30 volumes, over 1,000 pages per volume, all perfect spelling in the British spelling. Where did that come from? Well, what happened was, over in London, there was a print shop. And in that print shop, there were just all kinds of sets of type with A through Z, okay, and also with 0 through 9, over and over again. And that print shop was heated by natural gas. And somebody left the gas on. And by the way, it had all kinds of ink, all kinds of paper, all kinds of binding, all that stuff. And there, somebody left the gas on and somebody struck a match. And there was a big explosion. And things were blown in every direction. And when it all came back to earth, there was all 30 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica in perfect order. And that's what I bought. You don't believe that, do you? You don't have enough faith to believe that, do you? And I don't either. That's such nonsense. Well, that's the Big Bang. Except the universe is a whale of a lot more complex and perfectly put together than the Encyclopedia Britannica was. Now, if you can believe that the Encyclopedia Britannica came from an explosion, then you can be an atheist. If you can't believe that, then you believe that there's one true and living God, the God that is described in the Bible. And Him you must serve in order to be able to go to heaven